wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series. But with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This edition of The Wizards of Money is being broadcast right from a wilderness area of the National Forest in the Southern Appalachian Mountains. This is the 22nd edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled Ecotainment Gossip. Did you know that Mickey loves Smokey? In this, the 22nd edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the status of our public lands. And in that process, we'll look at particular private interests that are seriously courting the public land managers. As you can hear, I'm out in the woods myself today. I'm in a beautiful wilderness area of the Southern Appalachians. And as you can probably also tell, it's the fall, and you can hear the crunch, crunch, crunch of the autumn leaves under my feet. It's a beautiful day in a beautiful area. But something doesn't seem quite right. I have a very spooky feeling about this. Let me see what's going on. Uh-oh.
On the map, you'll find Arctic Cat in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. But it's wherever any road ends that Arctic Cat really begins. At Arctic Cat, we're in the people moving business, and oh, the ways we can move you. From the soft powder of a snow-capped mountain to the roughest rocky terrain, Arctic Cat can move you to sights you've never seen and get your adrenaline moving at a pace you didn't know existed. The most moving thing we can do is create memorable moments with family and friends that will last a lifetime. Arctic Cat is a company on the move, always has been, always will be. We started building ATVs in 1995. Off-road vehicles haven't been the same since. Our revolutionary new 2004 lineup will move you in ways you've never been moved before. Don't look now, but starting with our youth-minded 50 and running all the way up to our awesome 650, Cat has the broadest range of ATVs on the planet.
Whether Disney will become involved in the management of public lands or not is the $64,000 question. There's no company on earth better at branding entertainment than the Walt Disney Company. When you go to Disney, when you go to Disneyland or Disney World, you're not expecting to have some sort of an experience between you and a wild place. You are expecting to have a very controlled, very scripted, and very fun day. On public lands, it used to be you made your own adventure. But with people having less time for vacation, having more pressure on getting out there and making sure their vacation, as short as it is as filled with activities as it can be, a lot of people are saying, you know, I don't want to take my chances and maybe discover something good and discover it on my own. I want to be able to go off and consume something that I can reserve in advance and know that when I have returned 3 days later, I will have had a good time. And so the whole values for public lands are changing. Instead of them being places of discovery and exploration and a chance for people to actually get close to nature, public lands are becoming a place where you go and purchase a predictable recreational experience. The recreation has become trophy hunting these days. And the Walt Disney Company is most definitely working with the land management agencies to teach them how best to provide these trophy hunting opportunities.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the father of Earth Day, Gaylord Nelson.
We have about 620 million acres of public lands, national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges, BLM lands, a great heritage. It's being destroyed rapidly by this administration. If the Congress and the President want to save this remarkable heritage of public lands, there is still a window of opportunity, but it is closing fast. This great heritage will be gone in 30, 35 years, and they will all be noisy, polluted public lands with off-road vehicles of all kinds rushing all over. They're destroying the public lands, not only the parks, the national forests, wildlife refuges as well. So that's a great heritage that the future generations are going to be deprived of.
Grandpa made me quite a promise for the day I came of age. He said we'd walk through Appalachia, northern Georgia, on through to Maine. Dreadful sorry, my beloved, such a
Throughout this edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the past, present, and future of our public lands by hearing from some experts on the subject matter. We'll hear from a speech given on Earth Day 2003 by the founding father of Earth Day, former Senator Gaylord Nelson. We'll also hear from Scott Silver, the Executive Director of Wild Wilderness in Portland, Oregon. And, of course, we'll be hearing from Mickey Mouse and Smokey Bear themselves. The various transportation industries have been snuggly with American public lands ever since they were born over 100 years ago. Indeed, one has to wonder if the 19th century push for the designation of America's first national parks would have been so successful without the backing of the powerful railroad industry, who wanted the business of people moving between home and vacation spot. And what about the national forests? The Act of Congress that established the Eastern National Forest, the 1911 Weeks Act, makes no attempt at hiding the driving force behind this accumulation of public land by stating that national forest land acquisitions are to be made to protect the headwaters of navigable streams, that is, to protect the flow of waterways used for river-based transportation. And so it came to be that transport and tourism interests aligned themselves with the ideals of conservationists, and vast tracts of public land have been established in the form of national parks, national forests, and wildlife refuges, to name just a few. Scott Silver, the Executive Director of Wild Wilderness, explains all the different types of public lands we have, who manages what, and what's happening today on these lands.
There are public lands of all sorts. There are federally managed public lands, state managed, and then there's right down to your local park. Amongst the federally managed, there are approximately 700 million acres managed in total. Amongst 5 or 6 primary land management agencies, the National Park Service is one that most people are aware of, and they collectively manage about 80 million acres, I believe. The Forest Service manages approximately 192 million acres. The Bureau of Land Management is an organization many people have not heard of. It's actually one of the biggest land management organizations in the U.S. or agencies. It's about 260 million acres. Then there's the Bureau of Reclamation. It manages most, if not many, of the reservoirs around the country, and they're very heavily used for recreation. And then the Army Corps of Engineers is another one in that category. So that's basically for federal.
And what about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Well, Fish and Wildlife, sorry, I forgot that one. Yeah, that's a very important one, too. I think there are about 80 million acres preserved as wildlife reserves.
And can you talk about, of those departments that you've talked about, which are fall under the Department of the Interior?
Department of Interior includes the National Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, and Fish and Wildlife Service. The Forest Service is different insofar as it falls under the Department of Agriculture.
And can you talk about what's going on, the general trend with public lands management and administration in the U.S. right now?
Well, we went through a somewhat unusual period during the Clinton-Gore years where there was a general trend away from resource extraction and a general trend towards promoting recreation and tourism as the new businesses of those land managers. That was unusual insofar as recreation and tourism never really been thought of as a commercial venture. It was largely something people did on the public lands. But during the Clinton-Gore years, there was definitely a move away from managing resource extraction with such a heavy hand. And recreation and tourism was, among some circles, being promoted as and thought of as an alternative to resource extraction. Under the Bush administration, things have changed. Basically, the trend towards promoting tourism and recreation as commodities has continued, if not escalated, but the old ways of resource extraction have come back with a vengeance. And right now we're looking at truly plundering America's public lands of every resource that they hold today.
Now, somewhere along the way in the past decade or so, 19th century style enjoyment of nature's treats transformed itself into a whole new world of ecotainment ready-made for the 21st century. The paths of conservationists and the sectors of transportation, tourism and entertainment are diverging more than ever before. Ecotainment is the wilderness experience for the modern world in the 21st century. And just like everything else, the old way of experiencing nature was just too much work. Why, you had to exercise, gamble on the weather, the kids got bored, you got eaten by insects and scratched by plants, you'd have to carry your own food, and horror of horrors, sometimes you actually had to pee in the woods. Then, in the 1980s, the transportation and tourism sectors began offering solutions to this dilemma. Scott Silver explains this development.
What about this issue of what you refer to as industrial recreation and industrial tourism?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Well, it means it used to be, with the exception of the national parks, that recreation on public lands was basically something that people did in a very low-key, relaxing manner. It was typical that 10, 15 years ago, a family might load up the station wagon. This is before SUVs. They'd load up the station wagon with the Coleman stove and the tent and the various pieces of equipment used in camping. And they go off and find some quiet place by a lake, maybe have their canoe on top of their car, and go spend a week or even more enjoying being close to nature. What's happened in recent years is people have figured that experience could be improved upon. But improved upon says that instead of allowing people to have that kind of a simple pleasure, that perhaps what they really need is to drive around in enormous motorhomes. And instead of parking in a little spot nestled amongst the trees by this quiet lake, what they probably need is a great big pull-through spot where they could pull their motorhome through and hook up their sewer and their internet connections. And then the lake, rather than just allowing it to be something where a person could hand launch their canoe, perhaps it really needs a marina with jet boat rentals or maybe houseboat rentals. This is the trend we're seeing, a trend towards looking upon the public lands that are not developed today as being underutilized resources that, if they were more heavily developed, would become greater revenue generators and more of a contributor towards the national economy.
So who's driving this push for industrial tourism?
Well, it's being driven largely by a trade association in Washington, D.C., called the American Recreation Coalition. They consist of approximately 130 to 150 member companies, and they include everything from the manufacturers of snowmobiles and jet skis to the concessionaires who operate many of the campgrounds and national parks. They include tourism associations, campgrounds associations, things like Campgrounds of America. They're very, very heavily represented by the motorhome industry. And then they have interesting groups like the Walt Disney Company, which is not only a member, but it's a sustaining member, and the Disney Corporation is represented on the board of directors of the American Recreation Coalition.
And so what is the ARC lobbying for?
Well, they've testified before Congress multiple times over the last several years, saying that one of the reasons that caused the organization to be formed in 1979 was the creation of a recreation fee program on the public lands. The American Recreation Coalition has lobbied very hard to create a thing called the Recreation Fee Demonstration Program, which removes the prohibitions upon which recreational activities can have fees associated with them. And that program has allowed a vast proliferation of fees on public lands from one end of the country to the other. I was one of the first to start raising issues that the recreation fees were part of the recreation industry's efforts to commercialize, privatize, and motorize recreational opportunities on America's public lands. Today, there are 260 organizations that have signed on as being in opposition to the fee demonstration program. They include organizations with large memberships and well-known names like the Sierra Club. We see a pitched battle ahead that will be decided in the next year. And the battle is whether public land recreation will be brought to a pay-to-play paradigm, whether the private sector will become much more heavily involved in the management of those public lands.
Perhaps the greatest growth in ecotainment is the off-road vehicle experience, that is, all-terrain vehicles, snowmobiles, and jet skis. And today's technology is amazing. ATVs now come with new crawling features that enable you to navigate anything from the biggest boulder to the most remote stream. These things can just about go anywhere. And while illegal in most delicate areas of our public lands, all kinds of efforts are underway to legitimize their use anywhere and everywhere. On May 20th, 2003, National Public Radio's All Things Considered ran a story about the attempt to resurrect a Civil War-era road law to get even more space for off-road vehicles.
Over the past few months, the Bush administration has significantly changed the way public land is managed. Without revising a single law, without consulting Congress or soliciting public comment, the Department of Interior is making it easier for state and local governments to claim rights of way or roads across federal land. Opponents say it's a way of keeping land from being designated wilderness. Supporters say it's protecting the public's right to use public land. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
RS-2477 sounds like a license plate, but it's actually an innocuous title for an arcane legal loophole that's turning public lands management inside out. Enacted in 1866, along with the Homestead Act and the Mining Law to help settle the West, it was an open invitation to construct highways across public lands. It was repealed 110 years later in 1976, but valid existing rights were grandfathered in. Just what constitutes a valid existing right isn't spelled out. And that's led states, counties, and even recreational groups to lay claim to everything from mule tracks to dog sled trails that cross federal land.
So we drove in on Highway 313, paved road.
On a windy, piercingly blue day in Utah's canyonlands, Kevin Walker of the Sierra Club spreads a county map across the hood of a four-wheel drive rental, now caked in red dust.
And now we're this junction here where there's a very dense network of black lines. It doesn't look like it's
It's a tangled spider web of nonsensical lines, some broken, others paralleling and crossing one another and ending abruptly. A roadmap that would give anyone trying to get someplace a headache. But the map is actually a wish list of 6,000 miles that Grand County wants declared as rights of way over public land. At the heart of Grand County is Moab, fast becoming the off-road vehicle capital of the country. Hundreds of miles of slick rock on BLM land attracts thousands of jeepers, ATVers, and mountain bikers. Uranium once drove the economy here, now it's tourism.
And that's another reason why these roads are so important to us, is because that's why the tourists come here, is to use our roads, our trails. This is big bucks to us.
So the county has been meticulously documenting anything that remotely resembles a road on public land so it can claim it and take over management. Just as environmentalists have been walking and surveying every square mile of the same land for potential wilderness status. Each side says the other is engaged in a greedy land grab. The same scenario is playing out all over the West, in rural Alaska, the California desert, northern Nevada, places where locals chafe over federal control and where conservationists are clamoring for protection. In attempting to resolve disputes over RS-2477, the Bush administration is setting up a process to make it easier for state and local governments to claim these rights of way. And the old law isn't clear as to just who can make the claims. The Blue Ribbon Coalition, for example, the nation's largest off-road vehicle association, is filing rights-of-way claims as well, pushing for motorized access in Sequoia National Forest, Six Rivers National Forest, and the King Range National Conservation Area. Bill Dart is the coalition's public lands director.
You know, of course, our basic, interest is trying to protect our existing routes of travel out there, and it's all about protecting access.
Dart readily admits that means using road claims to disqualify land in the future from congressional protection as wilderness. And he says RS-2477 is a tool for the off-road vehicle users to rightfully ensure motorized access to public land.
You know, I don't think any of us want to be confined to just some kind of a theme park experience with hordes of other people. It's one of the things that we have that's so unique and wonderful about this country is we have these landscapes out there are so vast that you can get away from, civilization without having to carry it all on your back.
The Department of Interior has yet to process a single RS-2477 claim. When that happens, just about everyone agrees, it'll most likely be the courts that ultimately decide whether a road is really a road. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News, Moab, Utah.
Where in hell can you go? Far from the things that you know. Far from the sprawl of concrete that keeps crawling its way. About 1,000 miles a day. Take one last look behind. Commit this to memory and mind. Don't miss this wasteland, this terrible place when you leave. Keep your heart off your sleeve. Motherland, cradle me. Close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. Keep me safe, lie with me, stay beside me, don't go. Don't you go.
And since so much of this vehicle use is currently illegal on public lands, one has to wonder about the status of law enforcement. Here's Scott Silver again.
One of the more interesting things is the Department of Agriculture, USDA Forest Service, has identified unmanaged recreation as one of its four highest priority items to deal with. And that's in acknowledgement that the proliferation of dirt bikes and snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles over the last 10 or 15 years has been incredible. And so much of the wild places in America are being totally overrun by these motorized vehicles.
I guess one of the issues that arises is that where you do have designated ATV areas, there's a sector of ATV users. The last thing they want to do is be on designated areas. They would rather be on, out in the wild. Does the Forest Service have a way of dealing with law enforcement issues that arise there?
They don't. The Forest Service has very, very little ability to deal with law enforcement. First of all, we're talking about enormous stretches of land, and we're talking about vehicles that can travel over vast distances. When you have trails that go near wilderness areas, it's all too common that people will look out into the wilderness and say, gee, wouldn't it be great if I could ride my snowmobile up that mountain, and do exactly that. And the chances of there being some law enforcement officer there to apprehend them are very, very slim.
One of the most memorable branding efforts of the nation's public land managers was surely the creation of Smokey the Bear, the forest fire fighting bear introduced by the U.S. Forest Service and the state forestry departments in the 1940s. Smokey was not only a cute Disney-type character who helped the Forest Service learn how to brand itself, he also had a noble purpose: to prevent forest fires by targeting the major cause of them, humans. And you wouldn't believe it, but the Smokey character actually followed directly in the footsteps of Walt Disney's most famous forest critter at the time, Bambi. Bambi was used as the first forest critter on Forest Service fire prevention posters in 1944, hot on the heels of the release of the Bambi movie. And what a huge success Bambi was in this role. But Disney wanted Bambi back, and the Forest Service needed to brand its own forest critter. From 1944 onwards, Smokey ads played regularly on radio and TV for many years, complete with catchy, toe-tapping tunes about public lands and some words of wisdom from famous celebrities, like this exchange between Smokey Bear and Bing Crosby.
Smokey the Bear, Smokey the Bear.
Hello there, folks. This is Smokey, the forest fire-preventing bear. Those singing friends of mine, the Sons of the Pioneers, have a song for you. But first, how about joining us in a little visit to a big star? Today, it's Bing Crosby. Gee, Bing, this is a swell hunting lodge you have here in Elko, Nevada. But after all, you are one of America's best-known sportsmen and a wonderful entertainer.
All right, Smokey, you can stop pulling my leg. I'll talk about forest fire prevention, and I'll do it willingly, too. You know, I like to hunt and fish, and so do millions of my fellow Americans. And I think that those of us who use rod and gun, we get so much physical and spiritual enjoyment from the forest that we have a special reason, a special responsibility to keep them free from wildfire. Fires don't burn just trees, you know. They destroy the nests of birds. They kill wildlife. They burn up good hunting areas, and they ruin fishing streams for years and years to come. So let's watch our matches and smokes and our campfires. Let's be careful with fire in our forests. Well, there's my message, Smokey. I want to tell you something, too. It's right from the heart.
Thank you, Mr. Bing Crosby. And if folks will just take it to their hearts, we'll have less carelessness and less forest fires. It'll be like old times, maybe, when great herds of buffalo roam Nevada country.
Buffalo, 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 buffalo. They're gone from the plains of Montana, buffalo. There's none left in old Idaho, buffalo, buffalo. No longer their thunder, just bleached bones lie under the snow. Buffalo, 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 buffalo.
Well, that's it for now, folks. Thanks a lot for spending this time with us. You know, it's your own state forestry department, along with the Forest Service, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and this station you're listening to that make these get-togethers possible. Until we say hello there again and pay another little visit to another big star, this is Smokey and his pals, the Sons of the Pioneers, asking you to always remember, only you can prevent forest and woods fires.
Smokey the Bear, Smokey the Bear, prowling and a-growling and a-sniffing the air.
So public land started to become a little bit Disneyfied way back in the 1940s. And today, let's face it, most kids are going to grow up seeing more Disney animals than real animals that live on real public lands anyway. Naturally, the boundaries between Disney and the wild are getting pretty blurred.
The world is full of magic. Winter turns to spring. Small things become big. One thing always changes into another.
Walt Disney Pictures presents an all-new motion picture event.
Are we there yet?
Don't make me turn this formation around!
You have no idea where they are!
You just talked!
Just back away, real slow-like.
What's going on? What?
How's it going, Bear?
I'm not a bear.
Well, gee, eh? You're one big beaver.
No kidding.
I'm a man.
I was transformed into a bear, magically.
But crazy!
Gesundheit, do either of you know where the lights touch the earth?
No. No.
Hey, I know that place.
You do?
Yeah, follow me. My name's Coda. Say it with me. Coda.
Tell everybody I'm on my way, and I'm loving every step I take.
I don't want to brag or nothing, but I'm a raging ball of brown fur.
Oh, really?
This November.
Keep all that cuddly bear stuff to a minimum, okay, kid?
The truth is, I got separated from my mom.
See through another's eyes.
Those monsters are really scary, especially with those sticks.
Feel through another's heart.
Coda, don't be afraid.
And discover the meaning of brotherhood.
I always wanted a brother.
So one of the big questions of the day is, with the rapid growth in the ecotainment industry, and with public lands as the primary place to get eco-tamed, and with Disney as the world's grandest entertainment provider, just how involved are they getting in public lands?
With people having less time for vacation, having more pressure on getting out there and making sure their vacation, as short as it is as filled with activities as it can be, a lot of people are saying, you know, I don't want to take my chances and maybe discover something good and discover it on my own. I want to be able to go off and consume something that I can reserve in advance and know that when I have returned 3 days later, I will have had a good time. And so the whole values for public lands are changing. Instead of them being places of discovery and exploration and a chance for people to actually get close to nature, public lands are becoming a place where you go and purchase a predictable recreational experience. Recreation has become trophy hunting these days, and the Walt Disney Company is most definitely working with the land management agencies to teach them how best to provide these trophy hunting opportunities. Whether Disney will become involved in the management of public lands or not is the $64,000 question. They have been directly involved in the creation of the Recreation Fee Demonstration Program. Congressional testimony claims that top executives from the Disney Company and from REI have worked with forest managers to create these programs. And I just might add that there is a movement called the Wise Use Movement. The Wise Use Movement stems from a meeting of people who are interested in resource extraction and motorized recreation and basically very conservative interests that came together in 1988 in Las Vegas to form the Wise Use Movement. And they came up with a 25-point agenda of what it was they wanted to accomplish. And since 1988, they've accomplished most of what's on their agenda. But item number 11 on their agenda is to come up with a mission 2010 to reorganize the National Park Service and to turn it over to companies with specific expertise in transportation of moving large numbers of people, such as the Walt Disney Company, named by name. So I think we're seeing every evidence that the public lands are being turned over to large concessionaire entities. And they have names. They have names like the Delaware North Company, Amarac, Forever Resorts. There are large concessionaires that are controlling large amounts of the recreational opportunities on America's public lands. So far, the Disney name is not on that list. And everyone is wondering, will they become on the list or not?
Well, given that we're talking about public lands here, doesn't the public have some kind of input? The answer is technically yes, but in practice, no, if those that don't want public participation find convenient ways to circumvent the public participation process mandated by law. Over recent years, We have seen a great deal of pressure to close many of the avenues for public participation in public lands management, and several key decisions have been made in contrast to overwhelming public sentiment. Examples of this were the overturning of the Clinton-era roadless rule, protecting more than 60 million acres of national forest lands, and the reversal of the ban on snowmobiles in Yellowstone National Park. And now, these attempts to use the old road rule RS-2477 to legalize off-road vehicles on vast tracts of public lands are yet another example of ways to exclude the public from major decisions. The Bush administration's so-called Healthy Forest Initiative brings with it yet more attempts to exclude the public from public land management decisions. And forget about cute bears discouraging the public from starting fires in the first place. This fire initiative is all about getting rid of the fuel itself. Here's an excerpt from Working Assets Radio on August 21, 2003, where the host, Laura Flanders, talks to a former Forest Service employee, Jim Furnish, about this issue.
Let's clarify that and pick up on that, and then we'll get to one more call before the break here. Let me just ask you to clarify. 1969, the passage of the National Environmental Protection Act mandated that there be environmental impact statements before any government law or activity or project went ahead. We know that Gail Norton at the Department of Interior, like her mentor James Watt, is opposed to that kind of holding back of government policy as they see it. President in this tour he's been making talks about that part of this picture in slightly obscure ways, talks about speeding up the process, but he does say that he's proposing steps to promote early and more meaningful public participation in order to secure this more timely decision making that he's concerned about. What's he talking about by meaningful, more meaningful public participation? Let me ask you, Jim, and then David.
Well, there's really an arena, I think, of really laying open the planning process and really working with the affected interests to say, hey, what do we need to have happen here? And then making that all very transparent. Now, my argument is that those processes already exist. They need to be changed. And even the original 1969 law that you referred to, the National Environmental Policy Act, had a provision where certain activities could be excluded from this more open process. My concern here is I think they're in an unwarranted way, expanding the numbers and types of project that are excluded from that kind of environmental review, when I think they should more or less learn to live with the status quo, sit down and work hard with the communities of interest involved, hammer out the compromises and go ahead.
The United States pioneered the concept of federally managed public lands, such as national parks and national forests, in the late 1800s, and the rest of the world later followed suit. The role these public lands play in the water cycle, the carbon cycle, insect cycles, species diversity, and many other natural functions is generally taken for granted and will become ever more critical as population growth continues to gobble up available private lands. Sadly, however, in the 21st century, the United States is now leading the way in the trend towards privatization of public land services and in the technology for high-impact recreation on public lands. To close out this episode of The Wizards of Money, we're going to hear from a politician who understands all this, the former US Senator Gaylord Nelson, who is known as the founder of Earth Day and a sponsor of legislation that protected the Appalachian Trail. He spoke at the National Press Club on Earth Day 2003.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the father of Earth Day, Gaylord Nelson.
I was reading something recently, and it reminded me of the only joke I ever heard that was funny about pollution. And this was maybe 55 years ago in Madison. My wife and I and another couple went to hear Satchmo Armstrong at the Union Theater. And in the middle of the concert, Satchmo wanted a little respite, and he stepped to the front of the stage. He said, "When I was a little boy, I went out to spend a week with my grandma on the grandma's farm." She said, "Satchmo, get a pail and go down to the pond and get a pail of water." Satchmo said, "I came running back with an empty pail." Grandma said, "Satchmo, why didn't you get the water?" He said, "Grandma, there's an alligator in the water, and I'm scared." Grandma said, "Go back down and get the pail of water. The alligator is as scared as you are." I said, "Grandma, if he is, that water ain't fit to drink." Now for the humorous part of the forging and a sustainable society is the overarching challenge of every country in the world for this century and probably the next. All of them are consuming their capital resources and counting it on the profit side of the ledger. That isn't a sustainable situation in the long pull. The ultimate key to sustainability is population. When I was born in 1916, the population of the United States was 98 million. When the Second World War started with our involvement, the population was 132 million. And the year 2000, 281 million. The projections are that in the next 60 or 70 years, the population of the United States will go to 500 million at the current rate of increase. Then, in the second half of the next century or earlier, the population, we will join India and China as the 1 billion population club. What does it mean? It means we will double our population in a few decades, and we will, of necessity, double our total, think of the total infrastructure of the United States. Double it, twice as many houses, schools, colleges, restaurants, stores, service stations, prisons, airports, traffic jams, freeways, twice as much crowding and half as much open space. In short, we are headed into this century with no discussion, understanding, or plans for a future that will double and quadruple our population in a very short time. Of necessity, sustainability hearings must range over all significant issues on the environmental spectrum. That'll take a long time to cover. A national dialogue over sustainability will clarify the major issues that we must address and provide a political roadmap to the goal of sustainability. Without presidential leadership and extended congressional hearings, we will remain at a political stalemate on the challenge of our time until it was too late to do anything about the challenge. One good place to start would be public lands. We have the United States has the greatest collection and variety of public lands set aside for all generations to come if they aren't destroyed before they arrive. We have about 620 million acres of public lands, national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges, BLM lands. That's almost 1 million square miles. A great heritage. It's being destroyed rapidly by this administration. And the Clinton administration proposed a rule to phase out all snowmobiles in Yellowstone Park and substitute buses so you wouldn't have all of those noisy snowmobiles in the first park of its kind in the world. The first thing, almost the first thing that the Bush administration did was reverse that decision. Here's what Mike Finley, former superintendent of Yellowstone, had to say about the settlement between the Bush administration and the snowmobile industry. Quote, "This is the first time that the opinion of the park was not sought or solicited or considered by an administration. This was a top-down decision to settle this lawsuit. What this settlement represents is a repudiation of the American people and a sellout by the administration." If the end of quote from Mike Finley. If the Congress and the President want to save this remarkable heritage of public lands, there is still a window of opportunity, but it is closing fast. This great heritage will be gone in 30, 35 years, and they will all be noisy, polluted public lands with off-road vehicles of all kinds rushing all over. They're destroying the public lands, not only the parks, the national forests, wildlife refuges as well. So that's a great heritage that the future generations are going to be deprived of unless we light a fire under the Congress, the President, and so forth. Otherwise, they'll be gone. I'm sorry about my voice. But if it were better, you'd be here until midnight. I'll finish there.
The guest speaker today at the National Press Club is Earth Day founder Gaylord Nelson. It's time for audience questions.
If you were to grade the Bush administration on the environment, what sort of grade would you give it?
I don't think there's anything in the alphabet that would do it.
Did the war with Iraq make it more difficult to talk about the environment?
Well, any time you have a war or a depression or some event like that, environmental causes get set aside because everybody thinks you can postpone doing something, and so it tends to slow down environmental programs.
Recent polls have shown that half of young activists don't bother to vote. How can you make the environmental movement the environment a higher political priority and regain some of the political and policy successes of the 1970s?
Give the right to vote to grade schoolers. that's not as silly as it sounds. Grade school kids ask more sophisticated questions than college honors graduate asked 33 years ago.
Do environmentalists value the life or the preservation of animals over human advancement?
I don't think there's a choice. You can't. If you got rid of all the animals, you'd be rid of all the people.
That's all for Wizards of Money Part 22. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org.